This is Mission to Israel, a broadcast ministry featuring author, teacher, and evangelist Ted R. Weiland. It's our prayer here at Mission to Israel that our time together will inspire you, give you insight into current events, and reveal your place in God's plan. Our address is Mission to Israel, Post Office Box 248, Scottsbluff, Nebraska, 69363. Or contact us via the web at www.missiontoisrael.org. And now, here's Ted Weiland.
This will be A Man After Yahweh's Own Purpose, Part 13. And as usual, it's another series much longer than I initially anticipated. But God, again, is so rich in His Word that sometimes you can't hardly go two or three verses, or even one verse sometimes, without, you know, at least for me, preaching a whole sermon on it. So we're lucky to be in just part 13 as far as we're into this story. This, of course, the text for this series has been Romans 8:28. For God causes all things to work together for good to those who love Him and to those who are called according to His purpose. In the last message, we finished up with Genesis chapter 41. You might want to be turning to chapter 42. We finished up with Genesis chapter 41 in Joseph's life, which has gotten us through the 7 years of plenty, of Egypt's 7 years of plenty, and into the second year of famine. We don't know how far into that second year, but I suspect just barely into the second year, into the time when probably the spring harvest was already gone and unavailable. The famine, whose principal purpose was to fulfill Joseph's dreams. And don't miss that. That was, I mean, he put Egypt and all the surrounding countries into a famine state, principally, almost entirely, for the purpose of fulfilling Joseph's dreams that God had given him concerning his brothers coming down and bowing down before him and thereby preserving the people of Israel. As I pointed out in the previous message, at some point Joseph recognized, you know, I don't think it was initially when he first took the throne, but at some point he must have recognized that his quote unquote good fortune, this blessing from Yahweh, this incredible turnaround of events and conditions was not just for his benefit. I know he figured out it was for his benefit. But he suddenly must have figured out it wasn't just for his benefit, but indeed it was what was foreordained by Yahweh for his entire family and people so that they might survive the remaining 5 years of famine that they had no idea was even coming. And therefore, surely he was anticipating, after he had figured it out, probably in that first year, probably within the first week, too, or at least the first month, after he had figured it out that that's what was happening, surely he was anticipating and probably even preparing for his brother's arrival. Jasher's account concurs. If you will, let me read a little bit of a lengthy passage from Jasher. And I think you'll find it worthwhile, again, believing that Jasher's account is accurate, being that it is indeed recommended reading in God's Word. Jasher chapter 50 and verses 28 through 39, it says, "And the famine prevailed throughout the land, and the famine was in all countries, but in the land of Egypt there was produce for sale. And all the inhabitants of Egypt came unto Joseph to buy corn, for the famine prevailed over them, and all their corn was spoiled. And Joseph daily sold it to all the people of Egypt." So that's something that was added here, and it's talked about a little bit earlier in Jasher that the people's own corn spoiled, while the corn that he had stored away, however he had done it, preserved the corn. Verse 30, "And all the inhabitants of the land of Canaan and the Philistines and those beyond the Jordan and the children of the east and all the cities of the lands far and nigh heard that there was corn in Egypt. And they all came to Egypt to buy corn, for the famine prevailed over them. And Joseph opened the stores of corn and placed officers over them, and they daily stood and sold all that they sold to all that came. Now, essentially, that's where we left off in the last message in the biblical account, other than the fact that the biblical account does not say anything about the Egyptians' personal corn spoiling. Picking it up from there now in the book of Jasher. Verse 32, "And Joseph knew that his brethren also would come to Egypt to buy corn, for the famine prevailed throughout the earth. And Joseph commanded all of his people that they should cause it to be proclaimed throughout the land of Egypt, saying, It is the pleasure of the king and his second and their great men that any person who wishes to buy corn in Egypt to purchase it, but, he said, his sons," I wonder why he would say that, "his sons, and also any," I didn't quite read that right. Verse 33 again, "It is the pleasure of the king and his second and their great men that any person who wishes to buy corn in Egypt shall not send his servants," I missed that part, "shall not send his servants to Egypt to purchase, but his sons." Again, why would he do that? He said, if you're going to come and buy corn and other grains from us, you're going to send your sons. "And also any Egyptian or Canaanite who shall come from any of the stores from buying corn in Egypt and shall go and sell it throughout the land, he shall die, for no one shall buy but for the support of his household." In other words, there wasn't going to be any price gouging, and there wasn't going to be anybody else, someone profiting from someone else's misfortune. But there was another reason for that. You know, you can't go sell it to somebody else in your land. He wasn't going to take the chance that his family would have somebody else return from Egypt and sell them the corn. He was making sure that they came to Egypt. Continuing in verse 34, and it says, "And any man leading two or three beasts shall die, for a man shall only lead his own beast." Verse 35, "And Joseph placed sentinels," catch this, "at the gates of Egypt and commanded them, saying, Any person who may come to buy corn, suffer him not to enter until his name and the name of his father and the name of his father's father be written down. And what is written by day, send their names unto me in the evening, that I may know their names." Again, you can see what Joseph's plan is here. "And Joseph placed officers throughout all the land of Egypt, and he commanded them to do all of these things. And Joseph did all of these things and made these statutes in order that he might know when his brethren should come to Egypt to buy corn. And Joseph's people caused it to daily be proclaimed in Egypt according to these words and statutes which Joseph had commanded. And all the inhabitants of the east and west country and all of the earth heard the statutes and the regulations which Joseph had enacted in Egypt, and the inhabitants of the extreme parts of the earth came, and they bought corn in Egypt day after day, and then went away." Verse 39, and concluding with this, it says, "And all the officers of Egypt did as Joseph had commanded, and all that came to Egypt to buy corn, the gatekeepers would write their names and their father's names, and daily bring them in the evening before Joseph." So you know what Joseph was doing each and every evening of every day? He was going through that list, looking for the names he knew at some point would show up on some particular evening. Joseph was taking no chances that he might miss his brother's visit there to the land of Egypt. His recognition that what was occurring, and I don't know if you've even thought of this scenario or not, but his recognition that what was occurring was Yahweh fulfilling his dreams would also account for the fact for why during the 7 years of plenty that as the second man in charge of Egypt that he never attempted to make contact with his father. It says he went throughout all the land, but there's no indication nowhere that he made contact with his father. You know, why wouldn't he have done that? Well, I think he knew this had to be done Yahweh's way, to his purpose and in his timing. Mark this down. It's never, never wise or advantageous to run ahead of God, which is the same as saying to outrun Yahweh. which can't be done anyway. You know, try it sometime. You cannot outrun him. It just will not work. You know, I know one man who tried to outrun him, tried to outboat him, and tried to outswim him, and it didn't work. Good old Jonah. He found out you just don't get away from him, no matter how hard you try. So it's never to our advantage to try to outrun God. Joseph was obviously content to once again just wait upon Yahweh for him to accomplish his purpose in his life in his perfect timing. All right, having read that from Jasher, let's pick up Joseph's story now in Genesis chapter 42. Genesis chapter 42, beginning with verse 1. It says, "Now when Jacob saw that there was corn in Egypt, Jacob said unto his sons, why do you look upon one another?" He says, he's looking at his sons. There's no corn in. They're out of grain. They're about to starve. And he says, "Why do you look upon one another?" You may think, well, why does he say that? Well, that's just the polite ancient Hebrew way of saying, get off your duffs. Or today's southern redneck rendering is, get her done. Application. When there's something that needs to be done, get her done. And then do it with all of your strength and all the ability that God has given you in service to Yahweh instead of man. We're told that time and time again, certainly in the book of Ephesians and Colossians, both in the New Testament. And who benefits by doing so? Who is the one who benefits? If you do it with all of your might, with all of your energy, with all of your ability, unto Yahweh instead of man, even if you don't believe in God, who's going to benefit? Yahweh is served, certainly. But you and possibly anyone else in your sphere of influence is the one who benefits. Even if you don't believe in him, you still benefit by such a plan. And as witnessed on more than one occasion in the Bible, even praying sometimes doesn't substitute for doing what needs to be done when it's time that it should be or needs to be done. Even praying doesn't substitute. I'm thinking specifically of Joshua and the sin at Ai. And if you'll recall, Yahweh responded after Achan had taken the dedicated things and had hid them under his tent, and they had lost the battle of Ai as a result, and Joshua was down on his face before Yahweh. Do you recall what Yahweh said to him in that instance? In Joshua 7 and verse 10, he says, get thee up, wherefore liest thou upon thy face? He was praying. But God is essentially saying, this is not the time to pray. In other words, Yahweh was telling Joseph, get her done. You go do what you know has to be done. Back to Genesis chapter 42, picking it up with verse 2, and it says, "And he said, behold, I have heard," this is of course Jacob speaking to his sons, and he says, and he said, "Behold, I have heard that there is corn in Egypt. Get you down thither and buy for us from thence, that we may live and not die." And Joseph's 10 brethren went down to buy corn in Egypt, but Benjamin, Joseph's brother, Jacob sent not with his brethren, for he said, lest peradventure mischief befall him. And the sons of Israel came to buy corn among those that came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Verse 6. And Joseph was the governor over the land, and he it was that sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brethren came and bowed down themselves before him, with their faces to the earth. And they came down and bowed down themselves before him with their faces to the earth. Now, is Yahweh true to his word or what? Isn't that what that dream, those two dreams that Joseph had been given were all about, that they had scoffed at, that they had turned and used against him? As Paul wrote to the Roman Christians in Romans chapter 3 and verse 4, it says, "Let God be true," and of course he always is. He says, "Let God be true, but every man a liar, as it is written that thou," speaking of God, "mayest be justified in thy sayings." And of course he is that as well, always. You know, go ahead, Go ahead and scoff at Yahweh and His word, but know in the end that Yahweh will indeed be true to His word in every aspect thereof. He always has been, and He always will be. And you will be left with your scoffing and the consequences thereof. You know, Joseph's brothers were indeed liars. We know that. And they were surely scoffers as well. We know that as well. And you say, oh, those dirty, rotten scoundrels. Be careful. Be careful. Yeah, they were scoffers and they were liars and they were scoundrels. But what man or woman hasn't been? Besides Yahshua, there's never been a man true in all that he said and all that he's thought. So be careful about passing too harsh a judgment on Joseph's brothers. And instead, rejoice. Instead of looking around you and saying, oh, I'm so much better than them, you better learn to rejoice in Yahweh's forgiveness through Yahshua's propitiating sacrifice. And furthermore, then rejoice in His faithfulness to us in the fact that He always, forever, keeps His word. Just as He did with Joseph. Back to Genesis 42, verse 7. And Joseph saw his brethren, and he knew them, but made himself strange unto them, and spake roughly unto them. In other words, he made it so that he not only didn't reveal his identity to them, but chose to do whatever was necessary to conceal his identity. Continuing, verse 7. And he said unto them, whence come ye? And they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. Verse 8. And Joseph knew his brethren, but they knew him not. You might say that, he didn't reveal. Well, let me read from Josephus. This is Antiquities of the Jews, book 2, chapter 6, and verse 2, what his account on this very same thing. He knew his brethren, but his brethren knew him not. Josephus put it this way. He said, now when he well knew his brethren, they thought nothing of him. For he was but a youth when he left them, and was now come to an age so much greater that the lineaments of his face were changed, and he was not known by them. Besides this, the greatness of the dignity wherein he appeared suffered them not so much as to suspect it was he. Again, they sold the man into slavery. You know, if they expected to find him, they expected to find him probably carrying the burden of another man or who knows what else. They certainly didn't expect to find him in the quarters he was, dressed as he was, and disguised as he was. Verse 9, and Joseph remembered the dreams. Probably better he marked the dreams. He already would appear to have known about the dreams, have already remembered them. So marked or contemplated upon the dreams, you could probably see that as the better rendition. Verse 9 again, and the Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed of them, and said unto them, ye are spies, to see the nakedness of the land you are come. Now why do you suppose he would accuse his brothers in this situation, knowing that they weren't? Why do you suppose that he would accuse them of being spies? Well, of course, we really don't know the reason, because the context simply doesn't provide that for us, so we can only speculate. But here's my take on it. One thing it did, it gave Joseph the right to detain them. You're spies. He had the right to detain them and then to test thereby during that time to test their integrity. And it also provided the cover from which to question them without subjecting himself to suspicion. You're spies. And so he had the right to not only detain them, but to question them, to find out about their family, to find out about their father, hopefully to find out about another living brother, to find out what the situation was that he needed so desperately to know to make his plan in this situation work. Also keep in mind that Joseph knows that this drought and famine is to be prolonged for another 5 years, or possibly the best of 6 years yet. He knows that. They don't know this. And his objective, therefore, don't forget, is to get his father and entire family to the safety of Egypt. Therefore, he had to have been concerned that if he revealed himself to his brothers too early, that they might just up and hightail it back to Egypt, lie to their father to cover their tracks again. And so he had to make sure that this was done in a way that he could get his father and his their entire families, their people, back to Egypt. So, for perhaps those reasons and or possibly others, Joseph decided to play it coy, and at least for a while, and even accuse his brothers of covert intentions in this particular situation. Back to verse 9. And Joseph remembered the dreams, or contemplated upon them at this time, which he dreamed of them. And he said to them, "Ye are spies, to see the nakedness of the land ye are come." Verse 10. And they said unto him, "Nay, my lord." Nay, my lord. What a contrast to their attitude 22 years earlier when they declared, "Behold, the dreamer cometh." And now they're bowing their faces to him, saying, "Nay, my lord, nay." Quite a change. Verse 10 again. And they said unto him, "Nay, my lord, but to buy food are thy servants come. We are all one man's sons. We are true men. Thy servants are no spies." And he said unto them, "Nay, but to see the nakedness of the land ye are come." And they said, "Thy servants are 12 brethren, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and the one is not." And Joseph said unto them, "That is it that I spake unto thee, saying, ye are spies. Hereby you shall be proved. But by the life of Pharaoh, you shall not go forth hence, except your youngest brother come hither. Send one of you, and let him fetch your brother, and you shall be kept in prison, that your words may be proved, whether there be any truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely ye are spies." Now, there very well might have been in all of this, even suspicion. There certainly has to be concern about his brothers and whether these men have changed or not. But there also had to possibly, perhaps, be suspicion on Joseph's part concerning their story about Benjamin, his full-blood brother. After all, they all came but Benjamin. Where's Benjamin? You know, had they possibly harmed him as well? And he needed to find out what the intentions and what these men, the character of these men now were. Verse 17. And he put them all together in ward 3 days. So he takes all 10 of them and puts them in ward. He says, I'm going to allow one of you to go back, bring back Benjamin. 9 of you are going to remain. But before he does that, he puts all 10 in prison for 3 days. And of course, thereby they all got a taste of the same treatment Joseph basically, and just they just got a taste. But they got a taste of the same treatment Joseph had suffered at their hands. And those 3 days, whether Joseph intended it for it to be this, but would have certainly been a time for those 10 men, a time of reflection and hopefully remorse for all 10 of them. Reflecting upon, you know, what they had indeed done to Joseph 22 years earlier. Verse 18, and Joseph said unto them the third day, "This do and live, for I fear God." Now, bear with me. I'm going to take a rabbit trail here for a little bit. But one I think it's a good place to do it, and one that I believe I'm going to do so because there are people who need to hear it. The word God here is translated from the Hebrew Elohim. Again, verse 18, he says, "For I fear God, for I fear Elohim." And would not necessarily, is translated from the Hebrew word Elohim, and would not necessarily in itself indicate Yahweh. Because, and are you listening? Because Elohim, or forms thereof, are used in the Bible and were used in that day by other peoples for both Yahweh and other false gods of the day. Elohim, the Hebrew word translated God, was used not only for Yahweh, but for other false gods of the day as well. For example, it's the word that Yahweh himself chose to use. Are you listening? That he himself chose to use in Exodus, of all places, Exodus 23 in verse 13. I'll just read it to you, and it says, "In all things that I have said unto you, be circumspect, and make no mention of the names of the other gods, neither let it be heard out of thy mouth." In Hebrew, for that one word. He says, and make no mention of the names of other Elohim, neither let it be heard out of thy mouth. This is something that extreme sacred namers, as I like to call them, because there's almost in every position or every doctor, there's somebody on either extreme of the position. But something that I believe that extreme sacred namers should take careful note of. I'm talking about those and anyone else who use Elohim in place of the word God, the English word God in the Bible. Because, and here's the reason for doing it, because G-A-D pronounced God, here's at least one of their reasons, that G-A-D pronounced God was a name of a pagan deity. So according to Exodus 23:13, we can't use that name. We can't use the name God. Because G-A-D, God, was a name of a pagan deity, and also God was used for all of the other gods as well, at least in a generic sense. And again, Exodus 23:13 tells us not to use the name of other gods, the name of other Elohim. Now, are you catching the problem, the inconsistency of their argument? The very argument that they employ against using God demands that they also cease and desist from using Elohim, because it too was used, even by Yahweh, for other pagan deities. But the problem is not in Elohim or its English equivalent God. That's not where the problem's at. Or Yahweh himself was guilty of transgressing Exodus 23 and verse 13. And the same is true for Lord, English for the Hebrew Adonai or the Greek Kyrios. The problem is not in the word Lord. The problem is not in the word, they'll use master, which is the same thing. But the problem is not in the word Lord, and the problem is not in the word God. The English God and the English Lord are perfectly valid descriptions and titles for Yahweh. Now, they can't be used as replacements for his name, but they're perfectly valid descriptions and titles for Yahweh, as much as Elohim, Theos, Adonai, and Kyrios are. Provided you designate which God and which Lord you're referring to. And of course, the simplest way to do that is by employing his name Yahweh. Then you know which Lord and God you're talking about. The Elohim of Elohims, or the God of Gods, the Theos of Theoses, if I can stretch the Greek and the Hebrew in that fashion, or the Adonai of Adonais, the Lord of Lords, the God of Gods, Yahweh, the Lord of Lords, Yahweh. Yahweh's concern was not that we might call him God or Lord, but that we would call upon other gods and other lords. That was the concern. And here is additional proof positive of that very thing. Hold on to your britches. Well, I guess not all of you got britches, so you can't hold on to them. But hold on. Did you know that it is biblically correct to even identify Yahweh as Baal? My boy, that ought to make some people stand up and take notice. And I suspect it'll even get some of their hackles up. Some of them will get a little bit riled over that idea. But it's nonetheless true, and here's my justification for saying that. Because Yahweh himself inspired the word Baal, B-A-A-L, to be, and its Hebrew equivalent, to be used for himself in his word. Turn to some passages with me. Isaiah chapter 26. Isaiah chapter 26 and verse 13 is where we want to start. It says, "And O Yahweh our God, other lords besides thee have had dominion over us, but by thee only will we make mention of thy name. Now, let's kind of dissect this as quickly as we can here. It says, O Yahweh, when you get rid of capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, and put Yahweh's name back in where we know it's intended, where Yahweh inspired it to be. It says, O Yahweh our God, other lords besides thee have had dominion over us. Now, nobody's going to believe that God in this passage, who's responding here? Isaiah would be responding, I guess. That Isaiah is not saying that Yahweh, that he's indicating that Yahweh is the one who should have dominion over us. But instead, they had gone after other gods, and now those gods, those lords, have dominion over them. Again, O Yahweh our God, other lords besides thee, other Adonai in the Hebrew, have had dominion over us. In other words, but you're the one, you're the only one who should have dominion over us. Well, guess what? The word dominion is Baal. But only thou shall have Baal over us. Really, it could be just as easily translated as husbandry, or only thou should we have been married to. You'll see that a little bit later on here. Let's go to another passage, because that may not yet convince you. Let's go to Isaiah chapter 54. And by the way, don't take my word on this Baal being used in these passages. All you have to do is look it up in Strong's Concordance and you can determine it for yourself. Isaiah chapter 54, and beginning with verse 1, it says, Sing, O barren, thou that didst not bear, break forth into singing, and cry aloud, thou that didst not travail with child, for more are the children of the desolate than the children of the married wife, the children of the Baal wife, saith Yahweh. It's talking about the house of Israel and the house of Judah. The house of Judah was the married wife, the Baal wife to Yahweh. Still not convinced? Look at verse 5. Verse 5, for thy maker is thine Baal. For thine maker is thy Baal. Now, if there was, of course, it's translated husband, I'm sure in all of the translations we're looking at right now. For thy maker is thine Baal. Now, just in case there's any question about who their maker or creator was, it then goes on and says, Yahweh of hosts is his name, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, the God of the whole earth shall he be called. For thy maker is thy husband, for thy maker, Yahweh, is thy Baal. Jump over, let's go to Jeremiah. A couple more passages. Jeremiah chapter 3. Jeremiah chapter 3 and verse 14. Verse 14, Turn, O backsliding children, saith Yahweh, for I am married, or Baal, unto you. And I will take you, one of a city, and two of a family, and I will bring you to Zion. Turn, O backsliding children, saith Yahweh, for I am Baal unto you. Look at Jeremiah. Here's a familiar passage. Jeremiah chapter 31. Picking it up with verse 31, quoted, of course, in Hebrews chapter 8. Jeremiah 31:31, Behold, the days come, saith Yahweh, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah, not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was a Baal, a husband, unto them, saith Yahweh. The Hebrew word in all of those instances and a few others as well is Baal. It's number 1166 in Strong's Hebrew Lexicon, defined as, quote, a primitive root to be master, hence a denominative form of 1167, to marry, end of quote. Now, it says a denominative form of 1167. 1167 is defined by Strong's as from Old Testament 1116, so they're related to each other. A master, hence a husband, or figuratively owner, often used with another noun in modifications of this latter sense, end of quote. And then 1168, the Hebrew word in Strong's for the Phoenician god Baal, is defined by Strong's as at least the first part of it, other than it identifying it as the Phoenician, the god of the Phoenicians. It says as the same as 1167, which is from 1166, and which is used by Yahweh for Yahweh himself. In the Hebrew, all three words, you can look it up in the Hebrew and look at each and every one of them, 1166, 1167, and 1168 are the same identical word and sometimes used by Yahweh in description of himself, Baal. Now, I'm not suggesting that you read those former passages with Baal inserted therein. Isaiah 54:5, for thy maker is thine Baal, Yahweh of hosts is his name. I don't suggest that. That would be very confusing for the average Christian, wouldn't it? If we start putting Baal back into those passages. And furthermore, it's unnecessary to put Baal back into those passages because in those instances, the word Baal simply means husband or married, as the case may be. And for the same reasons, I refuse and I suggest that you don't replace God with Elohim or Theos or Lord with Adonai or Kyrios. To the average Christian, Yahweh is confusing enough, although I'll say this, not nearly so much as people let on. But it's difficult enough. It can be a stumbling block, although one we can't avoid. Yahweh is confusing enough, but add Elohim or Adonai to the mix, and it does then really become confusing for most people, where it's totally unnecessary. It's a stumbling block they don't need. Yahweh, our God's name, cannot be compromised. Or we're guilty of the same as the English translators who admit that they followed the traditions of the Jews and replaced Yahweh with Lord and God, making the commandment thereby of none effect and his name vain in his own word. That can't be compromised. We are not about to. I'm not about to compromise his name where God inspired it those nearly 7,000 times in the Old Testament. But God and Lord are perfectly lawful English renditions of Elohim, Theos, Adonai, and Kyrios. That's what they mean. So why put that extra stumbling block before them by replacing God with Elohim? They're as legitimate as husband is for Baal in some instances. And we no more need to remove the words God and Lord from our vocabulary, like some people are promoting, than we do the words husband and married. And if you're going to remove the words Lord and God from your vocabulary for the reasons that the lame reasons that so many extreme sacred namers use, then you've got to remove husband and married as well. Because they're translated from the Hebrew word Baal, or the very exact same word used to identify the Phoenician god. And furthermore, for anyone who demands God be replaced by Elohim, must likewise replace husband in those passages with Baal. Consistency demands replace God with Elohim. You must replace husband with Baal as well. But neither is in fact necessary. All right, end of the lesson, at least at this for this message regarding Yahweh, Elohim, Adonai, Theos, Kyrios, God, and Lord. Hopefully it's at least helped us to see through some of that confusion. And back to Genesis 42 and Joseph. Genesis 42, and picking it up with verse 18 again. Genesis 42, verse 18. And Joseph said unto them the third day, this do and live, for I fear God. Now, dealing with Joseph's situation, compare what he says there with Nehemiah 5 and verse 15. I'll read it to you. It says, moreover, from the time that I was appointed to be their governor in the land of Judah, from the 20th year, even unto the 2 and 30th year of Artaxerxes, the king, that is 12 years, I and my brethren have not eaten the bread of the governor. Verse 15, but the former governors that had been before me there in Jerusalem, now that they're back, were chargeable unto the people, and had taken of them bread and wine beside 40 shekels of silver. Yea, even their servants bear rule over the people. Even the servants of the governors were rulers over the people, he was saying. But so, Nehemiah says, so did not I because of the fear of God. Listen, it's only the fear of God, that is the fear of Yahweh, not just any God, but the fear of Yahweh that will keep those who would otherwise be despots from being one. As in Nehemiah's case, and certainly here in Joseph's case as well. And I'm not just, by the way, referring to leaders, though, because we all have the potential, even the proclivity sometimes, for some of us to be our own little or big despots. Or, without the fear of Yahweh, we might find ourselves instead, if we don't have that proclivity, we might find ourselves instead bowing and therefore serving the despots instead of Yahweh. And therefore, the fear of Yahweh, as is so many times commanded in His Word, is extremely important. And by the way, don't think that that means just reverence. Look up the words that are translated, both Hebrew and Greek. The Greek word is phobio, from which we get our word phobia. I mean, when it's talking about fear, it's a healthy fear of our God. Are we to love Him as well? You better believe we are, especially as Christians. But we are also, in case our love isn't as strong at times as it should be, we better have also a healthy fear of Him as well. All right, back to 42, verse 18 again. And Joseph said unto them the third day, this do and live, for I fear God. If you be true men, let one of your brethren, he said nine of you are going to be imprisoned. He changes it around. He says, for the fear of God, if you be true men, let one of your brethren be bound in the house of your prison. Go ye, carry corn for the famine of your houses. Verse 20, but bring your youngest brother unto me, so shall your words be verified, and you shall not die. And they did so. Now, why do you suppose that Joseph wanted them to bring Benjamin? Why not just reveal himself at this point and have them bring Benjamin, their father, and their families then instead of later? We got a long trip back to Canaan, long trip back, and there's got to be at least one more trip in order to get the father and the rest of the families back. Why, other than he's trying to do things according to God's plan, purpose, and timing, why do you suppose he would perhaps want to have them just go back for Benjamin? Well, I suspect that it was another test to determine their character and to see if anything had changed in the intervening 22 years. And it worked, because they immediately began to reveal their contrition to him. Look, pick it up with verse 21. And they said one to another, they hadn't even left the palace yet. Of course, they don't think he can understand them. And it says, and they said to one another, we are verily guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the anguish of his soul when he besought us, and we would not hear, therefore is this distress come upon us. Verse 22, and Reuben answered and said, Spake I not unto you, saying, do not sin against the child? And you would not hear. Therefore, behold, also is his blood required. Or in other words, his blood, they're saying, his blood is on our hands. And that's a clear reference, by the way, to Genesis chapter 9 and verse 5, after Noah and his sons and daughter-in-laws and wife left the ark. In verse 5, it says, and surely God speaking, Yahweh speaking, he says, and surely your blood of your lives will I require, at the hand of every beast will I require it, and at the hand of man, at the hand of every man's brother, will I require the life of a man. Verse 6, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, for in the image of God made he man. And in verse 22, Reuben reminds them of the fact that he tried to release them, and he says, also his blood is now required. Of course, they're probably convinced, although he is alive, they're probably convinced, and there was indication of that earlier when they said one is at home with their father and one is not, that they were probably convinced at this point that Joseph was dead. In fact, in Jasher's account, which I didn't read earlier, in the biblical account, they spent years, actually, going back and forth from Canaan to Egypt looking for their brother, according to Jasher. Never finding him after several attempts, they think he's dead. But, being that, going back to Reuben's statement about blood being accountable to them, being that kidnapping, and they were accomplices to the kidnapping, is a sixth commandment statute. And that's right, I said sixth commandment, not eighth commandment. Because the Bible uses the word stealeth and stealing and thief in Exodus 21:16, for example, where it says, and he that stealeth a man and selleth him, or if he be found in his hand, he shall surely be put to death. And in Deuteronomy 24:7, where it says, if a man be found stealing any of his brethren of the children of Israel, and maketh merchandise of him, or selleth him, then that thief shall die, and thou shalt put evil away from among you. End of Deuteronomy 24:7. Because the Bible in those passages uses the word stealeth, stealing, and thief, this statute is often mistakenly placed under the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal. But an important way to determine to which commandment a statute belongs is by the statute's judgment. A statute's judgment, think about it, a statute is subordinate to the commandment. They're what explains the commandment. And therefore, a statute's judgment must be the same as the judgment for the commandment to which it's subordinate. It can never be more severe than that of the commandment, again, to which it answers to. The judgment, if it's an eighth commandment statute, the judgment for the eighth commandment's transgression, or thou shalt not steal, is what? Restitution, not death. And thus, the prohibition against man-stealing or kidnapping is a sixth commandment statute, not an eighth commandment, because the kidnapped person is more often than not murdered while in captivity. Or even if that person is retrieved, that was more often than not the intent of the kidnappers. It is a theft, but it is only a theft of a person's life, not his possessions. And that it is therefore punishable by death, even if the kidnapped person is found alive. Therefore, because kidnapping is a sixth commandment transgression and is therefore equivalent to murder, Joseph's blood, even though he was yet alive, was nevertheless on his brother's hands at that time. Kidnapping is always has been to God a transgression of essentially murder. You have taken the person's life. You've at least murdered that portion of their life while they're in captivity. And oftentimes, of course, outright murder as well. All right, back to Genesis 42, picking up with verse 23. And they knew not that Joseph understood them, for he spake unto them by an interpreter, and he turned himself about from them and wept. He turns, he cannot face them any longer, hearing what they're saying, because his test is now starting to prove true that these men indeed had had a change of heart. And he weeps. Now, don't miss the profound irony in this. Joseph is weeping. He's touched to the very core, the very depth of his being, when most men, if we're honest about it, under similar circumstances, would be looking for revenge and retaliation. You see, like David, Joseph was also a man after the heart of Yahweh, as all must be if they hope to attain to men and women after the purpose of Yahweh. Or to put it another way, you will never be a man after the purpose of Yahweh without first being a man or a woman after the heart of Yahweh. The two must be hand in hand. Speaking of being a man after the heart of Yahweh, did Joseph's weeping for his brethren remind you of someone else? Turn with me to Luke chapter 19. Keep your place there. We're not quite done with it, with Genesis. Luke chapter 19, let's pick it up with verse 37. It says, and when he was come nigh, even now at the descent of the Mount of Olives, and of course we're talking about Yahshua, the whole multitude of the disciples began to rejoice and praise God with loud voice for all the mighty works that they had seen, saying, blessed be the King that cometh in the name of Yahweh, peace in heaven and glory in the highest. And some of the Pharisees from among the multitude said unto him, Master, rebuke thy disciples. And he answered and said unto them, I tell you that if these should hold their peace, the stones would immediately cry out. So there's this triumphant return to Jerusalem. And then in verse 41 it says, and when he was come near and beheld the city, he wept over it. Why? Verse 42, saying, if thou hadst known, even thou, At least in this thy day, the things which belong unto thy peace, but now they are hid from thy eyes. For the days shall come upon thee, that thine enemies shall cast a trench about thee, and compass thee round, and keep thee on every side, and shall lay thee, he's talking about the invasion of Titus, the Roman army in 70 AD, and verse 44, and they shall lay thee even with the ground, and thy children within thee, and they shall not leave in thee one stone upon another, because thou knewest not the time of thy visitation. Back to Yahshua and his weeping. He's weeping over the very city. Think about it. The very city, the very people who within days would crucify him. Joseph truly was a man after not only the purpose, but the heart of Yahweh as well. May we be the same. Back to Genesis 42, 24. I want to try to get through this chapter. And he turned himself about from them and wept and returned to them again and communed with them and took from them Simeon and bound him before their eyes. Interesting that Joseph took Simeon, who was second born. Normally, the eldest son in situations where all are involved or more than one sibling is involved, the eldest son would have been considered most responsible, for he was the one who was responsible. But if Joseph didn't know it from 22 years ago, and I suspect he probably did not, when Reuben was pleading for his life, it was probably off at some distance away from the pit that he was in. And when Joseph, if Joseph didn't know of it of 22 years ago, he now knew that Reuben had tried to intervene to save his life back that many years ago. And therefore, he imprisoned the next in line, Simeon, Jacob's secondborn. And I suspect, knowing how things usually work, that Simeon was probably the ringleader. And of course, imprisoned him as collateral, or as surety, if you will, as a guarantee for his brother's return. Back to Genesis 42, verse 25. Then Joseph commanded to fill their sacks with corn and to restore every man's money into his sack and to give them provision for the way, and thus he did unto them. Why? Why would he put the money back in the sacks? Well, perhaps simply out of goodness of his heart, or was it perhaps another test? Well, we don't know for sure because it doesn't tell us. Verses 26 through 28. And they laded the asses with the corn and departed thence. And as one of them opened his sack to give his ass provender in the inn, he espied his money, for behold, it was in his sack's mouth. And he said unto his brethren, my money is restored, and lo, it is even in my sack. And their heart failed them, and they were afraid, saying to one another, what is this that God has done unto us? Well, at least they're recognizing the sovereignty of God at this point in their life, and certainly probably seeing it as this being a judgment upon them. For surely, Aphnath-Paneah, as they knew him as, would view it as a theft, and surely decide that his original accusation of them being spies as being accurate. That's most of what they must have been thinking at the time. Verse 29 continuing, and he said unto his brethren, my money is restored, and lo, it is even in my sack. And their heart failed them, and they were afraid, saying one to another, what is this that God has done to us? And they came unto Jacob, their father, unto the land of Canaan, and told him all that befell unto them, saying, the man who is the Lord of the land spake roughly to us and took us for spies of the country. And we said unto them, we are true men, we are no spies. We be 12 brethren, sons of our father. One is not, and the youngest is this day with our father in the land of Canaan. And the man, the Lord of the country, said unto us, hereby shall I know that you are true men. Leave one of your brethren here with me, and take food for the famine of your households, and be gone. And bring your youngest brother unto me, and then I shall know that you are no spies, but that you are true men, so will I deliver you, your brother, and you shall traffic in the land. And it came to pass, as they emptied their sacks, that behold, every man's bundle of money was in his sack. And when both they and their father saw the bundles of money, they were afraid. And I'll bet they were. But, think about it, rather than being afraid, they should have been rejoicing. Rejoicing? What do you mean rejoicing? That's right, rejoicing. Rejoicing in Yahweh, who causes all things to work together for good. Rejoicing, that is, if now, that is, if now, like Joseph, they too were men who loved Yahweh and were looking for his purpose in their lives. And you know what? I think they must have been at this point in their lives. Because did not Yahweh indeed cause what was the cause of their fear to work together for their good, just as he promises in Romans 8:28? Indeed he did. You see, fear and worry is all just wasted energy. Wasting energy. For the man who loves Yahweh and who is looking for his purpose in their lives. Remember that the next time you're tempted to fear or you're tempted to worry. It's just wasted, and worse than that, it's wasting energy. For all things, God causes all things to work together for good to those who love him and to those who are called according to his purpose. Let's stand. We'll close this one in prayer. Heavenly Father, we do come before you. We thank you again for the story of Joseph and all that is therein to be gleaned. And I know that we're just scratching the surface. But Father, thank you for the lessons we've already gleaned, the ones from this message and the ones before, and that which you'll give us in the future as we continue down this series until it's completed. Thank you for the wealth that's in your word, that it is indeed living and active and sharper than any two-edged sword, and that it provides for our every need, Father, if we only look to it. We thank you, Lord. We glorify you in it. Let us be men and women now after your heart. Father, men and women who seek and love you and seek your purpose for their lives. We ask it, Lord, and praise you once again in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.